My name is Jim Morris. I am up here from Texas, where I live. I live in Austin, Texas. And I'm going to be talking tonight about my book, The Cancer Factory, which is set in this area, Niagara Falls, a little bit of Buffalo. And that's why I'm here tonight. And I appreciate very much the opportunity to talk about it. Let me start with a little background about how things were in this country as recently as the late 1960s for workers. So around that time, in the late 60s, about 14,500 workers were dying each year of traumatic injury. Another 2.2 million were disabled. And these numbers don't include the hundreds of thousands of workers who were being laid low by cancer and other occupational diseases. Many of these people would die one by one, 20, 30, or 40 years down the road. Other than their families and friends, hardly anyone noticed. Things are certainly better today, thanks to the passage of the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. But the numbers are not where they could be if we devoted more resources to worker health and safety. In 2022, the most recent year for which federal data is available, 5,486 workers died on the job, which was a nearly 6% increase over 2021. Employers reported 2.8 million non-fatal workplace injuries and illnesses, up 7.5% from the previous year. Both these numbers are almost certainly gross undercounts because a lot of injuries and illnesses go unreported, especially illnesses. According to the International Labor Organization, about 2.8 million workers globally die each year from unsafe or unhealthy work conditions. The ILO estimates that, quote, one worker dies at least every 30 seconds from exposure to toxic chemicals, pesticides, radiation, and other hazardous substances. That number, too, is almost certainly an undercount, the 2.8 million. In this country, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which everyone knows as OSHA, has been starved of resources since its creation 54 years ago. Most of its chemical standards are outdated, if they exist at all. And in fiscal year 2022, the agency spent $3.99 per worker on enforcement, according to the AFL-CIO, which is less than you would spend on a Venti cafe latte at Starbucks. Gives you a little sense of our priorities in this country. Meanwhile, states like Texas, where I live, and Florida are trying to turn back the clock to the bad old days, taking away heat protections for farm workers and other outdoor laborers, even as climate change makes the summers in those places hotter and longer. The Cancer Factory chronicles one of the worst outbreaks of cancer, in this case of the bladder, in an American workplace since World War II. While much of the action takes place from the 1940s to the 1990s, there are lessons for today. One is that corporations, and the main ones I'll be talking about this evening are DuPont and Goodyear, can't always be trusted to do what's right for consumers and their own workers. Another is that health hazards many of us thought had been eliminated, and should, in fact, have been eliminated a long time ago, are still very much with us. In 2022, the nonprofit news organization I founded, Public Health Watch, which is now just turned 3 years old, broke the news of a cluster of the deadly lung disease, silicosis, among mostly young immigrant workers in the Los Angeles area who cut and grind the sorts of artificial stone countertops many of us have in our homes. These are the fake stone countertops that look like natural stone. These workers weren't warned that the cutting and grinding unleashes silica dust, which becomes toxic when it embeds in the lungs. 172 cases of silicosis have been diagnosed among stonecutters in California just in the past few years, and no doubt there are many more. And you should bear in mind that silicosis is a disease that quite literally goes back to ancient times. The ancient Greeks and Romans, stonecutters, miners, were getting the same disease millennia ago. So this is nothing new, and yet here we are. And you have to ask yourself, why are workers in 2024 still getting a disease like silicosis? California did issue an emergency rule to try to slow this epidemic, but it's a safe bet that Texas and other states aren't even tracking the disease. So I want to start by reading the opening paragraphs of the book's introduction. This book took me about 5 years to write, and it's an outgrowth of a story I wrote in 2013. So I'll just read from the introduction. Around 4 o'clock in the afternoon on August 4th, 1992, during a bathroom break from moving furniture, Rod Halford began urinating blood. Not a little blood, sheets of it. It was, quote, such a startling effect, he would later testify in a deposition, that, quote, I jumped back and the blood went all over. Halford, then living in Youngstown, New York, near Lake Ontario, had the presence of mind to hold his urine stream and ask his wife, Nellie, to bring him a jar so he could capture a sample. She brought him a baby bottle. Halford called his family doctor, who told him to dump the bottle's contents and report to Mount St. Mary's Hospital in Lewiston, 7 miles away, the next morning. There, Halford gave another urine sample, but a proper analysis wasn't possible. There was still too much blood. X-rays were taken 2 days later, and a urologist at Sisters of Charity Hospital in Buffalo gave Halford the results on August 10th. He had a malignant tumor on his bladder the size of his pinky fingernail. The tumor was removed without general anesthesia. God knows how. Halford had vetoed the idea of being put under and staying overnight in the hospital because, he explained in his deposition, Nellie couldn't drive his pickup truck, which had a stick shift, and, quote, I just don't relish hospitals anyway. There was, Halford admitted, some discomfort associated with the procedure, to say the least. At the time of his diagnosis, Halford was the 18th employee of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company's chemical plant in Niagara Falls, New York, to develop bladder cancer. Halford had started the plant as a chemical operator in 1956, become an electrician in 1970, and retired as a janitor at 55 in 1991. His tumor was, to some extent, foreseeable. By 1981, when he was president of Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Local 8277, he knew of 4 co-workers with the disease. By 1988, he knew of 8. Federal health investigators invited into the plant by the union found 15 cases of bladder cancer. At this writing, the unofficial tally stands at 78, although I was told just yesterday it's probably 81 now. Either of those numbers might well be an undercount given the challenges of tracking retirees. Some of the victims are dead. In fact, probably many of the victims are dead now. Others live with the anxiety of knowing their malignancies, contained by surgery and chemotherapy, could resurface at any time. There's little, if any, doubt what caused the Goodyear cancer cluster. From 1957 onward, Rod Halford and his co-workers in Niagara Falls inhaled, and more important, absorbed. And bear in mind, these guys would go to work at the time in T-shirts and jeans. They didn't have any protective gear. And it turns out this chemical is very easily absorbed into the skin. They'd get it all over their arms, their hands, face, feet, and so on, but nobody told him anything. Anyway, absorbed the chemical called orthotoluidine, which was known internally as Dominic. I have no idea why. The chemical was used to make an anti-cracking agent for tires. Halford would come home from work stinking of it. It made his wife gag when she washed his clothes. It seeped through his pores while he slept, leaving a brown stain on the sheets. Documents show that its primary manufacturer, DuPont, knew by the 1950s that this yellowish liquid caused bladder cancer in laboratory animals and was protecting its own production workers in New Jersey against exposure. But DuPont either didn't adequately warn its customer, Goodyear, about the risks, or Goodyear didn't listen. Maybe both companies were at fault. That debate may never be settled. Not large by the standard of its neighbors, the Goodyear plant had a history with chemicals that made it a pernicious two-headed beast. 11 years before Goodyear started buying orthotoluidine from DuPont and a few other manufacturers, began using a chemical called vinyl chloride to make polyvinyl chloride, or what we would know as PVC, a resin fabricated elsewhere into vinyl garden hoses, shower curtains, siding, and other products. Like orthotoluidine, vinyl chloride is a potent carcinogen, though it targets the liver instead of the bladder. By the time Goodyear closed the PVC side of the plant in 1996, 11 fatal cases of liver cancer had been recorded among its workforce, which was about four times what would be expected in the general population. Same with bladder cancer, by the way. There was a fourfold elevation, which means it could not have been due to chance. There was something going on there. Few outbreaks of occupational illness in the U.S. have been documented as thoroughly as the one at Goodyear's Niagara Falls factory. Few offer a more striking example of how blue-collar workers were exploited after World War II. Generations of them, starting with a tide of veterans fresh from the battlefields of Europe and the Pacific, eager to ride the surging industrial economy, were misled about the safety of the chemicals they made and used. Men who had avoided death or serious injury in the Hurtgen Forest, the jungles of Guadalcanal, encountered in workplaces like Goodyear an adversary they couldn't see, one that weakened untold numbers of them over time and lopped years off their lives. This was the bargain they unknowingly struck in exchange for company picnics, Thanksgiving turkey giveaways, and paychecks big enough with overtime to allow the purchase of fishing boats and weekend cabins. Many stayed in the same factory for years and believed what their employers told them. Things like, substance X won't hurt you, or in extreme cases, and this was a literal quote from somebody, you could eat this stuff for breakfast and be fine. Not so. Employers and their trade associations, we now know, understood the enormity of such falsehoods. So in researching this book, which I said took about 5 years, researching and writing it, I encountered a number of fascinating characters, most from this area, with one exception. But I want to highlight three of them today. One is Steve Watka. He is a now retired lawyer from New Jersey who represented 29 of the Goodyear workers with bladder cancer in lawsuits against DuPont and other suppliers of ortho-toluidine. The second is Harry Wiest, who worked at the Goodyear plant for 33 years and has suffered four bouts of bladder cancer. And the third is Harry's father-in-law, Ray Klein, who worked at Goodyear for 39 years, has endured three bouts of bladder cancer and on-the-job heart attack, prostate cancer, and I learned yesterday now has lung cancer, never smoked. These men saved me from writing what I think would have ended up being a pretty dull policy book that no one would read. They were generous with their time and willing to share even painful experiences with me. Steve Watka is a protege of the late Tony Mazzocchi, who was a leader of the now-defunct Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union and a fierce advocate for worker health and safety. In 1969, as Congress was considering what would become the Occupational Safety and Health Act, Tony and Steve organized a series of union meetings to catalog just how awful conditions were in OCAW plants. So here's a description of the meeting from the book of a meeting in Kenilworth, New Jersey. A 22-year-old worker at the Diamond Shamrock PVC plant in Newcastle, Delaware, had been sent in to clean a tank without a spotter. His body was recovered after he'd been missing for about an hour. His corpse was blue, its tongue swollen to four or five times its normal size. He'd been asphyxiated by some undetermined poison. Company doctors who practiced in the domain of Local 8-623 in Bayonne, New Jersey, were suspected of withholding information about industrial illnesses from workers and threatening outside physicians with non-payment if they connected their patients' conditions to their jobs. Workers at Union Carbide in Bound Brook, New Jersey, believed they were exposed to high levels of mercury during electrical tests. A janitor at the plant who'd inhaled vinyl chloride fumes for 25 years could, quote, hardly breathe and was, quote, almost blue almost all the time. Harold Smith with Local 8-447 and Woodbridge Chemical in Hawthorne, New Jersey, complained of inhaling mercury and chlorine. Quote, the masks don't keep all of this out of your system, Smith said. When I go home at night, I have roast beef and fumes. If I have dessert, I can still taste some of the chemicals. His father and uncle had worked at a plant next door to his for about 20 years. Both were dead. The uncle had been consumed by throat cancer and, quote, died like a dog. So you have to remember, this was 1969. This was not the 19th century of Charles Dickens. Really not that long ago. So Steve Watka left the OCAW in the early 1980s, got his law degree, and began representing Goodyear workers in Niagara Falls after it became evident that there was a growing bladder cancer problem at the plant. His ailing clients had to sue third parties, mostly DuPont and a few other chemical suppliers, because the workers' compensation law kept them from suing Goodyear. His first Goodyear client was a man named Richard Sullivan, and this again is from the book. Sullivan, a big stoic man, was deposed in Buffalo over 2 days in April of 1989. Then 55, he was still shaken by his cancer diagnosis almost 3 years earlier. His testimony followed a pattern that would be repeated as Wodka acquired cases against DuPont. Sullivan was asked to describe in excruciating detail all the jobs he did at Goodyear and estimate how many times and in what ways he might have been exposed to ortho-toluidine, which, of course, is impossible. DuPont's lawyer, Paul Jones, quizzed Sullivan on his personal habits, fishing for anything other than the suspect chemical that might have set off the plaintiff's cancer. Did Sullivan smoke? Yes, a pack or a half pack of unfiltered Chesterfields a day. He had quit off and on, he said. Did he drink alcohol? Not anymore. He used to when he was socializing, he said. Did he drink coffee? Yes, 4 or 5 cups a day. Did he consume sugar or artificial sweeteners? Yes and no. Did he eat red meat? Not often. Did his home have formaldehyde insulation? No. Was he on city water? Yes. And on it went. And so the point here, I'm going to stop for a second, it's the anything but my product defense. So you have an obvious known carcinogen that is making these guys sick. And so the defense lawyers for DuPont are looking for any other thing to blame. Did you drink a beer when you were 17? Oh, that must have been it. I mean, it's just ludicrous. You know, when there is an obvious sort of elephant in the room there, and they're ignoring it. None of Steve's 29 bladder cancer cases from Goodyear went to trial. All were settled out of court. Though retired, he still cares deeply about the sick workers and their families, still gets angry when he thinks about what happened to that little plant at 5500 Goodyear Drive in Niagara Falls. While DuPont was his target in court, Steve maintains that Goodyear could have done more to stop the onslaught of disease. Quote, they knew more at the critical times than they let on, he told me. Had they been proactive, had they been honest about what they knew, you would think that most of the cancer cases could have been avoided. Ray Klein, another key character in the book, grew up in the central Pennsylvania coal country. He went to work for Goodyear in 1961, starting on the PVC side of the plant. Here, he was exposed to high levels of a sweet-smelling gas called vinylchloride. He had no idea it was a potent liver carcinogen. Ray and his wife, Dottie, suffered 3 unimaginable tragedies early in their marriage. Their first son, Mark, died of spinal meningitis. Their next 2 children, John and Donna, died of severe birth defects that may or may not have been linked to Ray's vinylchloride exposure. Dottie blamed Goodyear nonetheless. Ray eventually moved from the PVC side of the plant, known as Department 145, to the rubber chemicals side, known as Department 245. Here he was exposed to another carcinogen, a stinky yellow liquid called ortho-toluidine. Again, reading from the book. For many years, Ray knew it only as Dominic and had no appreciation of its potency. He encountered it while connecting and disconnecting rail tank car lines and unplugging NALAX reactor lines. NALAX is the end product that they were making at that, they still make at that plant. His protective equipment consisting only of safety glasses, a hard hat, and porous cotton gloves. Sometimes his lips and fingernails would turn blue while he was repairing pumps or working inside reactors or vessels called degassers. The medical name for the condition is cyanosis, and it's usually caused by a lack of oxygen. Ray experienced it at least a dozen times. He'd enter the tanks with no respiratory protection, only a rope tied around his wrist in case he passed out and had to be extracted. Ray and other mechanics would use scoops to put the gunk in cloth bags, as if it were dirt or sand instead of a malignant brew that could sicken or kill them. Ray had ortho-toluidine splashed on his hands, arms, legs, and feet with regularity. Sometimes it soaked through to his skin. Ray and Harry Wiest, his son-in-law, are extremely close, but their personalities could hardly be more different. Ray is short, stocky, and very guarded. He rarely complains. Harry is half a foot taller and gregarious. He's not shy about blaming Goodyear and DuPont for his and his former co-workers' illnesses. Harry started working at Goodyear in 1977, bagging PVC resin in Department 145. He later became a mechanic, taking him into Department 245 and exposing him to ortho-toluidine. As I explained in the book, Goodyear was not an oppressive place to work. The plant was a sort of blue-collar social club where workers tormented one another with practical jokes, threw money into betting pools, bowled and organized outings to Buffalo Sabres hockey games and Buffalo Bills football games. Opportunities for overtime pay were plentiful. 1 8-hour shift at regular pay might be followed immediately by another at time and a half, meaning one could get 20 hours of pay for 16 hours of work. There was a pecking order, but young workers were welcomed into the fold, assuming they were reasonably competent and good-natured. But the plant had its lethal secrets. One was vinyl chloride, the liver carcinogen. The other was ortho-toluidine, the bladder carcinogen. Ray Klein, diagnosed with bladder cancer in 1997, was case number 21 from the plant. Harry Weiss, diagnosed in 2004, was case number 37. Goodyear was in denial about the outbreak well into the 1980s and didn't make significant engineering changes to the plant until the early 90s. At one union meeting, Goodyear's corporate medical director at the time, Clifford Johnson, tried to convince the workers that they had a better chance of getting bladder cancer from grilled meat than from any chemical in the plant. Ray and Harry suffered unimaginably because of their exposures, and they're not out of the woods. Bladder cancer is among the sneakiest and most persistent of the cancers. Just when you think it's gone for good, it reappears. I was at the hospital with Harry in 2019, right up the road, when he learned his tumor had come back. He looked as if he'd been hit in the face with a 2x4. At one point, Ray underwent 6 weeks of chemo, which I write in the book, quote, required the insertion of a tube into his urethra, the injection of strong cytotoxic drugs, and the holding of those drugs in his bladder for 2 hours. The pain, he would say later, nearly brought him to his knees. Ray, the ultimate company man, tried to tough it out. Harry would hear him vomit in a plant restroom before handing out the day's assignments in the maintenance shop. As if all this weren't enough, Diane Weiss, Harry's wife and Ray's daughter, died suddenly in July 2021 of COVID-related causes. Harry called me the morning it happened. He could barely speak. So I want to close with just a couple of other things. The lesson of the cancer factory, there are many lessons, but one take is from, here's a take from Dottie Klein, who was Ray's wife. This is from the book. She said she was a, quote, Christian lady, close quote, who had forgiven Goodyear. As the conversation progressed, however, her resentment spilled out. Her husband, Ray, had had 2 bouts of bladder cancer, a heart attack, and prostate cancer. His rewards for 39 years of service were second-rate health insurance and a gnawing fear that his tumor would reappear. She had lost 2 children to birth defects she believed were related to Ray's work. Quote, I am a Republican capitalist, Dottie said, but I don't believe corporations have played fair with their employees, and that's across the board. You cannot put a monetary value on people's lives. And I want to close with the very last paragraph of the book, which I think kind of sums up the situation we're in. Goodyear shows no sign of ending its use of ortho-toluidine. In 2021, the Niagara Falls plant received 2.56 million pounds from manufacturers in India and China. The same year, Goodyear reported net sales of $17.5 billion, a 42% increase over 2020. It employed some 72,000 people at 57 sites in 23 countries. Its chairman, president, and CEO, Richard Kramer, received $21.4 million in total compensation. Ray Klein, octogenarian, bladder cancer survivor, and loyal Goodyear employee for 39 years, made $13 an hour delivering auto parts. In his mid-80s, I might add. That's it.